Hello and welcome to Chats, the television podcast, season 14, The Chatsovers. In this season of Chats, we are covering the 2014 HBO drama, The Leftovers. My name is Alan, and I'm joined by a guest who asked that I run him through with a samurai sword for $5,000 so he could feel something. It's Magellan.
That's the sound I make when you stab me with the sword. Okay.
He actually asked me to do this before every episode, listener, which is tough because we do record this remotely, so I have to send an assassin and I communicate to them to not do their job and assassinate him, but actually to just aim away from the arteries.
They do it straight through the leg.
Yeah, the femoral artery. We talk about The Leftovers eventually on this podcast, and it's a great show. It's one of my favorites. We are watching it. Magellan's watching it for the first time. I've seen seasons one and two. We're here. It's Chats. Any more table setting you need? Let's put this nice tablecloth on it. First off, we watched The Leftovers season one, episodes 5 and 6, Gladys and Guest, the double G episode this week. First up is Gladys, which was written by Damon Lindelof, the showrunner, directed by Mimi Leder, unsure. It aired July 27th, 2014. And Magellan, my dear, sweet friend, can you please tell me what happened in Gladys?
In this episode, Laurie's resolve is put to the test in the wake of a brutal hate crime. After his latest initiatives to maintain the peace in Mapleton fall short, Kevin turns down an outside offer to rid the town of its problems. Matt brings his pulpit to the street. Meg takes on a new role.
Meg's new role as in she takes the vow of silence at the end of this episode?
I think so, yeah. It's like I'm officially fully a guilty remnant, wearing white, smoking cigarettes, not talking kind of person.
Yeah, and this is all preceded by the inciting event, the titular moment involving Gladys, a guilty remnant member, older blonde woman who is tragically stoned to death in the woods at the beginning of this episode bunch of citizens of Mapleton. In a really, really gruesome scene that does not pan away at any point to hide the violence happening to this guilty remnant member. This was a lot, right? This was like, did this push it too far?
Yeah. I mean, the thing to know about The Leftovers is that they're always going to put the most upsetting thing at the very beginning of the episode. Right. Which, I don't know. I was settling in. Okay, I'm going to watch my night of TV where I watch the show we're doing for Chats, that fun show that I do with my friend. Oh my God. The fuck is happening? Yeah. So I don't know. We could have a conversation about, like, is this violent to the point of being like titillating type of thing? Like, oh, this is like a spectacle. I don't know. I just know. It was a lot, and it really looked like we were watching someone get stoned to death, which is not something that I expected to see, mm-hmm. and it was very upsetting, and I think that was the point. But be warned, it was awful.
Yeah, the episode starts on that, and I think the narrative purpose of showing it is so that the moment feels very real and that you're fully, like, involved in it in a way, you know? We are all of those people who watched and looked at it and let that guy do it, and stood by and just, like, observed because,
you know,
this is a guilty remnant person. And what we kind of learned in this episode, I'd say, about the group is that people just, it's not that they want to keep ignoring them because they can't ignore them. They are by nature unignorable. And so what people would rather do is, well, if I can't ignore this, if I cannot push this away like I've put away grief, then I want to destroy it. I want to wipe it off the face of the earth. And that, in a way, bookends the episode with, you know, a moment of physical violence at the top and then a moment of structural violence at the end as Kevin gets that call from one of the agents who says, basically, you say the word, we're going to send a bunch of people in there and we're going to take the guilty remnant out of Mapleton and make them go bye-bye, which is ghoulish. And it makes us confront our empathy and makes us think, well, okay, they are causing problems pretty consistently and they are criminals and they're not, like, actively helping anyone. And they're not staying in their own lane the way that we leave a lot of people who are spiritual. It's like, well, okay, Matt Jameson can do what he wants in his church because he's in his church. He's not forcing on people. The Guilty Remnant are, by design, forcing their views on people and converting and buying up property, as somebody says in this episode. So, like, this is just not a problem you can ignore. And for so many people, like the police, like a lot of the citizens of Mapleton, the only option left seems to be violence. And it suggests that we have just really been dealing with them for a lot longer than, like, we in the series have, which I think can kind of create a disconnect. Because you mentioned in your notes that, like, it's interesting how this show has jumped ahead in time so much. What was the deal with that? Because it's like, I don't even know where we're at timeline-wise now, but I know it's been a good while since, like, Two Boats and a Helicopter, for example.
It's the kind of pacing that I think works better in a book, where you are already asked to do so much imaginative work to meet the book on its terms, that for the book to say, like, 3 weeks later, this happened, you can say, okay, let me take that information in at the pace that makes sense to me. Let me corroborate that with what I already know. Oh, I kind of forgot what happened earlier. Let me go back and reread that. Whereas in a TV show, I think, at least what I'm more used to, is imagining that there's only like a week or a day or a couple hours between episodes. And this show is presenting events on a time scale that makes sense for a real world. A real world isn't going to have like community level events on a weekly basis. They're going to be spaced out week to week or month to month. So it's more realistic. But I think it also, like you're saying, it's a show that's preoccupied with these sort of structural matters. And it just demands of you, and this isn't even a bad thing, it's just demanding of you as a viewer the investment to position yourself in that. Because yeah, this episode, I think Kevin talks to Matt about the Guilty Remnant buying the church, about it happening like months ago, and it was like two episodes ago for us. So
And I think too that like all of the violence in that is showing us that time passing matters in The Leftovers, and that there's a sort of tragedy too of like, what are we missing when the camera cuts away and the episode ends? Is we're getting snapshots of this town, and the show ends up being a little bit about the town. But I ultimately think that the purpose of Gladys's death here is to engender empathy for the Guilty Remnant, because up until now we've seen a lot of like, okay, they seem really weird. They like smoke these cigarettes, and their ideology seems a little bit different from mine, and they're kind of harmful to others. There is even a scene, I believe, in this episode where they see an old man falling down in the street and they don't help him. They walk over him. And you're like, are the Guilty Remnant bad people? But you cannot, should not be able to see a scene like Gladys's death and not feel some sort of sorrow or badness for that, because you can't. So I think ultimately that's like what they're doing. And also with like, to the timescale point, like this is just has become systemic. And, like, the town can't keep ignoring them anymore. And that's what we're building towards. It's like, how do we, quote-unquote, handle the remnant now?
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin is kind of our perspective character for most of this outside of the Guilty Remnant. He is surprised, by the way, when the two main sides of the plot intersect, that Patty is obliging. When he's like, okay, you guys need to not be in your compound for a while. And we need you to, like, go, like, integrate among society a little bit. And you're going to stay in some hotels. Can you just do that? And he's like, yeah, I know you're going to tell me to say, go fuck yourself. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then she writes on her pad, of course. And he's like, oh, I don't actually have to be a cop for once. I can just tell people things that are in their best interest, and they do it. This is great. But then he gets pushback, coincidentally, from the tobacco chewing man, who we learn in this episode kind of in a hilariously offhanded way, is named Dean. Because that guy is staying around. He was wanting nearby one of the witnesses of the killing of Gladys. And like some guy walks by him and goes like, hey, Dean, what's up? And he's like, hello. And Kevin just looks at him like, what the? How did? All right. I guess you're a real person. People just know who you are. Kind of like laughing at us a little bit, or just joking that we were expected to believe that he wasn't a real person. You know, I thought that stuff was all very enjoyable. And then this scene that I really wanted to get your take on, like where Jill gets called out to talk to her dad. And she immediately starts sobbing. Because I have never been in that scenario before. At first, I thought that her crying was a little bit dramatic. But when you considered, like, she just is a powder keg waiting to explode. And your dad, who is a police officer, coming to your school and being like, I need to talk to you. That's your first instinct. Is like, yeah, my mom's probably dead, right? I think I came to understand it. And the moment later when she's like, I shouldn't be crying. I didn't need to cry over this. Because she says she wouldn't have cried over me, basically. Did you feel like that scene was a little bit overdramatic? Because I think that's my thing with The Leftovers, is sometimes it also tips into the melodrama.
Yeah, it definitely can. I think there are other scenes or times where I have that criticism, or honestly, times where the show feels like kind of edgelord moves are being taken.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't feel that way about this scene. I think she's already in a kind of tense, weird space, because the way the scene starts is she's passing her hand over the flame of the Bunsen burner.
Right, right.
And there's something about that. And what state is she in that she's taking that action? She's like trying to put on a certain facade for her friends. She's trying to test the bounds of her mortality. Like, those things are already on her mind and kind of like on the surface for her. And you have to think that like that behavior probably started, maybe not started exactly when her mom left, but certainly that exacerbated it, I would imagine, if the show is about people who feel burdened or abandoned. The scene does a good job of telling us what's already on Jill's mind, and then showing us that shot of Kevin talking to her teacher from far away before we even know what they're talking about, to put us in that space of like, hey, just think for a second how Jill feels, what she might be predicting Kevin's talking about. Because also, I was wondering if he was there talking about the mom, because we just prior to this saw Lori faint. It turns out she had a panic attack, but
yeah,
the episode was letting us draw all sorts of conclusions. I thought maybe she had like a stroke or a heart attack or who knows what it was. So maybe he was at school talking about that. So I think that the scene does a really good job of, through visual choices, of like putting us in Jill's shoes and then reeling us back out of that as Jill realizes what's actually going on. Kevin sort of handles that scene well, and then
to a point
and then when Jill's like, she wouldn't cry for me, and she walks away, he doesn't like close that loop or try to repair that harm or help her feel better. And so you can understand why Jill doesn't have like a way to process this stuff, because her dad is going through the same stuff and isn't like any more emotionally mature than she is, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so it worked for me, but I definitely feel that criticism about other parts of the show, that it can be
melodramatic
for sure.
The two angles of this scene that work for me the most are, we're starting to see Jill and Lori actually having some parallels about like, I don't want to forget my mom, I don't want to forget my daughter, and I don't like the way that things are right now. And I keep saying this, but it seems like the theme of the Garvey family is like, you know, I really don't wish I felt this way. It's like these people actually need Holy Wayne in some ways. And then on the other hand, you have Kevin, who, like you were saying, cannot engage as a parent and even just say something like, I love you, or I'm here if you need to talk, or anything to like bridge that gap. But we can literally go to like two scenes from now. Kevin is yelling at Detective Vitello, swearing at this guy in the precinct, because where he can lash out is where he can assert control, not where he can accept that he doesn't have control. He cannot Jill feel better because he doesn't know how to, but he can yell at people until things work the way he wants them to.
Well, and that's how the episode ends for him too, right? With the shirts and stuff.
Exactly. Precisely right. Yeah. I want to get to that in just a sec. But yeah, he's this Detective Vitello guy. I mean, we've seen him around before. The only note I had about this moment is like the mayor just walking around the precinct is kind of interesting. I suppose because there's just been a major like hate crime, that it makes sense that the mayor is like in the sheriff's department talking to local police. But it just always reminds me of that, like, Kevin's supposed to be the mayor of Mapleton and they changed that. So like occasionally they have to just put Lucy in scenes to do like what Kevin would have done.
Yeah.
But it also means that we get to see more Lucy, who's like one of the best side characters on the show by a long shot.
She's great. Yeah, she's great. Yeah, it's a little strange, the intimacy of their relationship. Like, do we want a mayor and a police chief to be working that closely with each other? But it is fun to see them in the same scene.
And so Kevin is like pulling overnight, watching over the guilty remnant as they stay in their hotels. Dennis calls him saying that he's going to pick up Matt Jameson. Before we get their wonderful interaction, we get the introduction of the laundromat stuff. Kevin apparently left 8 white dress shirts at the laundromat, and this wonderful guy is just like, you don't have the ticket? We don't have shirts for you. I don't know what you're talking about. I think this is a sort of like dark parallel to the bagel scene. Or like not this, but the conclusion to this, more specifically, the part at the end of the episode. Because here Kevin's like, well, why don't you have it? I know there's a line, I don't have a fucking ticket, but like, I know I brought you 8 shirts. And the guy's like, you didn't. And once again, he's like, you can't tell me that the reality around me is wrong. I am asserting my reality. There are 8 shirts in your laundromat for me. And that escalates all the way to him, like, you know, assaulting that guy, going into his store when it's closed. And like, the guy is absolutely shaking, afraid for his life. And he clearly gives Kevin like 8 random shirts. He never had them. So Kevin is like inventing a reality around it. I don't think those were Kevin's shirts. Did you?
It was hard to tell. It didn't seem like it, given how the guy was flipping through the shirts. And it seemed like he was picking them randomly from the rack. But they also seemed like they're all the same size. Like,
yeah,
the episode wasn't clear. They could have been more clear if the point was they were random shirts, that they were random shirts. I'm trying to decide if the ambiguity is useful. I think it is, because it means that it's hard for us to gauge whether or not what Kevin did was justified, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's entirely possible that they were his shirts, or that they had already sold his shirts. But it's also entirely possible that he lost them, or they're in the laundry hamper at home, or who knows. It's useful for us to not know, because I think the point is it's fucked up that Kevin is doing this. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to feel like, okay, you know, I understand why you're upset. I understand where this is coming from, but like, you are putting violence out into a world where you're trying to like diminish the violence that's out there.
Exactly. And it further, like, me, I really do think it works that they made Kevin a cop instead of just being the mayor, because having the power to enact that violence is like a specific criticism of police in America, and not just like of a mayor who runs around and is like, do do do, I can like assault laundromat workers and no one gets mad at me because I'm the mayor. Yeah. Like, that just makes a lot less sense to me.
Yeah, and it lets them continue to explore another thing from the pilot where he says people aren't ready to like feel better, they're ready to fucking explode.
Yeah.
And they can keep seeing what that looks like when he's a cop.
And so one of the last Kevin scenes, just him talking to Matt Jameson, and Matt's like reading a Bible quote to him about like understanding. Oh, Kevin literally asks him to explain the Bible quote, and I didn't write any of it down. It's a very long Bible passage.
Super long quote. Passage. I'm glad that finally there was a thing where someone quotes the Bible and another character's like, okay, but what does that mean?
Jesus said to his disciples, compare me to something and tell me what I am like. And Thomas said to him, teacher, my mouth is utterly unable to say what you are like. And Jesus said, I am not your teacher. Because you have become intoxicated from the bubbling spring I have tended. And he took Thomas and withdrew and spoke 3 sayings to him. When Thomas came back, his friends asked him, what did Jesus say to you? And Thomas responded, if I tell you what he spoke to me, you will pick up rocks and stone me, and fire will come from the rocks and devour you.
You want to tell me what that means?
It means it's easier to stay silent than it is to speak truth.
I was literally thinking when Matt was saying the quote that it's like a pet peeve of mine when shows quote the Bible, because it just kind of like sounds right, but like, are you really thoroughly kind of explaining that? And then they did explain it, and I don't remember what the reason was, but it was satisfying to me.
Sometimes it's easier to, it's like about telling the truth and being honest with people. You're saying I should delete my Bible passage from my notes for later, right? It's probably not.
No, you should read it, but I want you to explain it.
Okay, I'll do my best. It's also one sentence, so don't worry too much. It's not like it's not a whole story about a guy and a person and all the stuff. A guy and a person.
You can quote the Bible. I just don't like when in lieu of dialogue, a character's like, you know, John 3:16 says da 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 da.
It's, I was gonna say like, oh, you're not gonna like the show as a joke, but like, it's a Matt Jameson thing, right? It's like how people write priests is that they're constantly quoting the Bible, which like, hey, I yeah, know
but
my
the,
own.
But I'm saying this show did the right thing, which is they put a lampshade on the trope and said like, okay, buddy, but come on, explain it, as yes. opposed to other shows that don't do that. So I'm not criticizing Leftovers. I'm saying I like what they did, because otherwise it's annoying.
Matt is recapping Two Boats and a Helicopter, basically. He's like, yeah, so this stuff happened. And Kevin's like, yeah, and then they bought your church. Like, they, as if like we didn't watch that episode. But then they don't get into the darker parts of it. And Matt's just saying that at the end of the day, he really wants to pray for Gladys's body. And Kevin is like, no, like, you're a suspect. And he's like, yeah, I know. But like, eventually I won't be, because I didn't do it. So like, I can pray for her body, right? And he's like, no, Matt, it doesn't. That's weird and inappropriate. People really think right. you did it. And even if you didn't, right. they still think you did it. Last week, Kevin seen Kevin explaining the curfew at a town hall. I just like this because it's basically an argument between lovers, him and Dean fighting, while everyone else is like, yeah, they are fighting. Yeah, I do agree with this Dean guy. It does suck. We don't need it, because it's just people saying, like, why should we cater to the guilty remnant and have an 8 p.m. curfew to protect them when, like, shouldn't we be the ones being protected? Which I have complicated feelings about, like, police instituted curfews. I think that they're kind of messed up generally.
Sure.
But the episode is definitely painting the crowd as a little irrational, as if it's like, well, you're going to see why this was a bad idea and we should have done the curfew. But also the mayor, like, didn't give Kevin a chance. He's like, we should do this. And she's like, you have to defend it tomorrow in front of the council. And he's like, that's the best he gets. And then the council outvotes him 8-1. Instead, he takes the cop out, but joke intended version, which is that he hands the guilty remnant a bunch of whistles and says, if you guys need help, whatever, you guys go about and do your stuff. Whistle for somebody if you need help. The cops are here to help you. The police are here to protect you guys. Let's see how that goes. I'm sure it's going to go great. Bunch of bad stuff happens to him at once. We get this Killini guy in the background of the episode who keeps calling Kevin, and Kevin's calling him. He's like I think he's an FBI agent, if I understood correctly.
He is an agent at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, Explosives, and Cults.
Which they have somebody say like 4 or 5 different times this episode.
Yeah, because alcohol, tobacco, and firearms is real. Mm-hmm. In real life, and then they added explosives and cults for the show to be right. Like, hey, there's a lot of cults now.
There's enough to warrant adding to it.
Yeah, it's a little corny, but I guess it's probably what would actually happen in real life.
Yeah, at some point, this show is also kind of about cults right now, so it makes sense.
Yeah.
The guy tells Kevin over the phone. There's like this running thing about like, oh, Jill, you need to arm the house when you're home. And then he like forgets the code to the house and sets off the alarm. And then later he gets it. And there's this very like stress inducing scene where he can't disarm it. And the guy who's finally calling him back.
I really like that a lot.
I feel like we've all been there in some sense where like too many things that you wanted are happening at once. And you're like, no, fuck, no, stop. Can you just.
Yeah.
Like, give me 30 seconds, please, life, please. But he does finally get to talk to the guy, and the guy is just a freaking villain. He's like, hey, you know, guilty remnant kind of sucks. You want to get rid of them? Tell us. We'll send some people to make them go bye-bye. Seems like some state-sponsored violence, if you ask me, listener.
Yeah.
Kevin declines for now.
Well, and then just to jump ahead, what we see at the end of the episode is what else they do at alcohol, tobacco, firearms, explosives, and cults. Because Kevin's like, okay, well, the body was sent to you. Can we get the body back? And the guy's like, you know, once she's in the system, there's nothing I can do. And the reason for that is because they are incinerating the bodies of cult members who've been assaulted to like brush this stuff under the rug and hide the evidence. And it's like, super grim.
There's like a think piece point in here about bodies and how we see a lot of like fake corpses in the series, but also when a real person really dies in the present of the show, it's like the way that people don't want to talk about it is also how they don't want to talk about the departed. And it's like, right. Yeah, but this is like specifically like the reason you don't want to. We burn certain bodies, right? We burn specific people's bodies because we don't want to address their existence and give them a proper burial. Which is tragic. My one bad complaint, though, the Gladys like prosthetic that they use for that scene looks nothing like the actress. It's like kind of bad, but it's like a 20-second shot, and the emotional weight is obviously there, and it's a good shot to end the episode on. Just to wrap though, let's talk about the Guilty Remnant, and specifically Patty and Lori's happy hour at the diner. This is time I go to New York, by the way.
The best. It felt exactly like that.
Great diner content. Great and Dowd content.
Wow, she's so good when she's talking and when she's not talking. But when she's talking, holy crap. What an engaging performer.
Mm-hmm. She is basically telling Lori, hey, now that we're in civilian clothes and we're quote unquote off duty, I'm going to let you have a day off. You're allowed to have a day off. Congratulations, Lori. Enjoy it. Go ahead and talk. And Lori's just not going to do it because again and again and again, being in the Guilty Remnant means committing and always committing day and night, even when nobody's around. That's how religion works also. And the Guilty Remnant is for some people a faith.
Yeah. And it turns out that it's a test that Patty's doing to her.
Because like, I did the same thing to Gladys, right?
Yeah, right.
Gladys was worried about her husband and was worried about all this stuff. And then I did this to her and she also didn't talk. So great job. You understood the assignment. Even when we're off duty, we're still on duty because that's not, we don't turn this off, which is just really beautiful. And I think like what works is, you know, I watched that Drew Gooden video essay recently about, I guess it's like 10 minutes. So it's a video, not a video essay, whatever, about like what makes good acting. And the thing he said that I've always agreed with is that good acting is not yelling and crying. And even though Ann Dowd does like do a little bit of crying here and it feels kind of like sudden, the good acting is her just talking and like deeply engaging with Lori's ethos and being like, hey, check it out. I know you are feeling a lot of grief and you think it would be easy to just go back, but that isn't how this works. It's never going to feel like the way you want it to.
Yeah.
The only thing that's going to be stable for you is staying here. So you should stay here and stay with us.
I think the thing that's also really powerful in the performance here is that Ann Dowd makes it clear that Patty is struggling with the exact same thing, right?
Yeah.
Because, and like when she's delivering this performance, her face is like contorting and she's starting to make movements and sounds that are like sudden and a little scary, like she's violently fighting back full emotional expression. And then for that to end with the moment where she gets the doggy bag and she like scrawls the name Neil on it in this almost like, yeah, like kind of violent motion. It was really good. And you're like, oh, God, Patty, who's Neil? Go talk to him. It's okay. Leave him a little present or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Introducing Neil also as a name to keep in mind for later.
Mm-hmm.
Any predictions? Or did you already look it up?
As in, is Neil someone we know already?
No. But what do you think a character named Neil would be all about that makes Patty feel so bad?
I'm assuming it's somebody from her past who she's connected to, like a partner or a child or something like that.
I remember the Neil stuff being really good. That's why I ask.
Okay. I didn't expect there to be Neil stuff, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is interesting.
I think it's more of a season two thing, actually. But regardless, Patty and Lori talking, or rather just Patty talking and Lori listening, is really great. Being the actress playing Lori must be so tough. You just have to act against Ann O'Dowd, who's just like swinging for the fences, and you're like, and like all you do, your instructions are just nod and like agree. I just today watched an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation about a character who communicates through other people.
Okay,
and it was so interesting because the actor who plays him, because he's deaf, and the actor who plays him is also deaf, and so as a result, the episode has like great things to say about like disability and communication, but also it's like, how do you communicate through other people? What do you use, like sign language? Do you use written language? And how do you communicate emotions and ideas? And so it was kind of cool to see the parallels of like the Guilty Remnant being like this fun Star Trek episode I just watched. It's an interesting acting exercise, like acting without speaking, I think. Like I know a lot of acting schools straight up do stuff like that, or improv classes even will be like, yeah, you know, do scenes without talking, but try to communicate something. And yeah, they do the stuff with the whistles. And then finally, one of the big emotional moments in the episode, Matt Jameson comes to the Guilty Remnant place with his church and says, hey, we're here. You guys don't have to come out here, but if you choose to come out here, you can come pray for Gladys. And that'd be really nice, wouldn't it? And Lori comes outside and you, the viewer, even have a brief moment of like, is this her test? She's going to crack? But she goes out so suddenly that you're like, wait, what? And then she pulls out her whistle and she doesn't let Matt continue. She just whistles her way through the sermon, basically, because she's committed. And everybody inside looks at her so proud and so happy that she committed. And that's one of the big emotional moments of the episode also. I like that part a lot. I thought that was brief, but like pretty affecting to be like, yeah, you sometimes being the guilty remnant does mean being a little bit of a shit to other people because they're in your space and because they are trying to bring their influence to you. But
yeah, I think it also says a lot about Matt's hubris because he sort of names his mission as I want to bring these people back to life.
Yeah,
which
he literally says that.
Feels, you know, when you hear him say it, it's like, yeah, wow, that's so poetic. That's so interesting. But like these people are grieving and they are processing this and they're doing things on their terms and in their way that are acknowledging this death. It's not as if he's enlightening them to the concept of honoring someone who died, but he's sort of acting as if he is. So it's just this interesting moment to me where what he's doing isn't necessarily wrong. I think it's like a very charitable, generous thing. And also I think there are some ways in which the way that he does it is condescending and not necessarily receptive to how the guilty remnant want to operate and the ways that they express these things. So I really liked that scene a lot. I thought it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's one of my faves from this, I think from this season, honestly, because it really hits. And I just like seeing Lori get characterization, you know, and be like, hey, I made a choice. And I really appreciate that. The show does a very good job of not making the guilty remnant seem completely like bad guys. And I think that's where this episode is its greatest success.
Yeah. It also reminds me of Ty's sister in the Digimon movie using her.
She's got the little whistle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Why did I immediately know what you were talking about? Because I have good taste, listener. That's why. I love the Bare Naked Ladies on that soundtrack.
I believe the scene is from the Digimon
movie. Herman Cain said something like that. Any stray nuts on this one?
Yeah. They've got to stop doing the stuff where Kevin is attracted to Amy. Like, stop it. Him looking down the hall, she's in her like night underwear or whatever. Quit it.
Wild.
Who needs this in the show? What is this like accomplishing? I don't know. They keep doing it and it's really frustrating to me.
The only reason I'm okay with it, well, there's two things. In this episode, that shot you're referring to where she's in her underwear is very not titillating. It's very like, oh, that's a person, that's like a teenage girl, you're supposed to feel very weird about that.
True.
Like, that's, it's not true. Like, oh man, could they have been doing stuff? Like, you know they're not. And that's Amy's character, right? It's like they aren't giving her a backstory, they're not going to give her like an episode, but Amy's character is all about seeming like she's the kind of person that would do that and never actually doing it, which kind of puts her in conflict with Jill, someone who will put her hand on the Bunsen burner and will, like, you know, go out and steal the baby Jesus because she enacts things, whereas Amy says she'll do things but is way too afraid to actually do things. But
and
shows,
I think,
like, not saying this loud enough.
And I think the other thing, setting up Amy as a foil to Jill, is, like, Amy really wants to seem like an adult or like get along with adults and see things from their perspective. She wants to have a cordial relationship with Jill's dad. I think she likes those moments where he's like, what's up with Jill? And she's like, man, you and I, we're always trying to figure out what the deal is with Jill, but she's kind of got her own thing going on. But us, yeah, we're the mature ones.
Cool.
I think that works for me as like, make her Jill's friend to accentuate the ways in which Jill is leaning into this sort of like rebellious, slam my door shut teenager thing. But I think there's ways to do that without stuff like this. I don't know. It's weird.
It's,
but I know it's supposed to be weird and uncomfortable, so I'm just monitoring it. I really like the shot where Patty shows up to Kevin's house and holds up the legal pad that says like one of our, and we can't see the rest of what's on the pad, but we don't need to know because we already know what it says. There was like some economy to the visual storytelling there that I thought was really cool.
Yeah. I didn't think about that, but that's a really good point.
Meg, what's up with Meg? She's like, man, are you surprised that she got killed? Okay, Meg.
Yeah.
Yikes.
She's developing. She's evolving.
Yeah.
Slowly.
When Kevin asked Dean what he was doing in the woods, he says, drinking beer, stargazing.
Did you notice his beer brand?
What is it?
Really dumb trivia. His beer brand is Heisenbrow because they were fans of Breaking Bad.
Okay. All right. Okay. When Lori sees the little kid and the little kid's like, hi. And the mom says, Amanda, stop staring. And then looks at Lori and says, you too. That said a lot.
Townspeople are so mean.
They're really mean. I think what works for me about the Guilty Remnant and the way the townspeople see them is it kind of boils down to the most essential theme, this idea of like, how do people act when there's a group of people who force them to think about something or confront something that they don't want to?
The answer is you get angry really fast.
Yeah, you get angry really fast and you're like, I don't give a fuck if they get killed.
Mm-hmm. I had a couple quickies.
Oh, yeah.
Lori gets, when she has her panic attack from the doctor, a box of what I believe is diazepam because it's in a box. So it's probably big tablets. I don't mean to be that person, but you probably wouldn't just get handed a controlled substance from your doctor, even if you just had an emergency like that. And he does say, like, a doctor, you'll have to see a psychiatrist if you want more of these. I don't know. Maybe they do that. I think you would at least have to go to the hospital's pharmacy. That's just me nitpicking because I worked at a pharmacy and I know how controlled substances kind of work. And then my other huge ones were just the needle drops when Patty plays music in her car. Say so much about who she is and what she likes. She gets Kiss on my list by Hall & Oates, which lets you know that she's had fun at some point in her life. And then she gets What a Fool Believes also when she brings the thing to Kevin or whatever. And it's just, Patty has really good taste in me. I love both of those songs very much. So I was excited to see him.
I like that Lori's like, where are we going? And Patty's like, relax. Let's just listen to the vibes.
We're vibing.
Is this the first episode where someone says Guilty Remnant? No, right?
I don't think so. No, it must have been in the pilot.
Okay. Because mostly people have said GR. But yes. I don't know that I caught a moment prior to this point where someone says Guilty Remnant. But I'm sure they did.
Yeah, me too. I had the same thought, though. I was like, this feels different. Very cute little cinematography. The hotel leaving the no smoking signs in the rooms that they know the Guilty Remnant are in. I know this is poetic irony. I know they leave them in every room before someone's like, Alan, come on. It's funny. It's a funny moment of dramatic irony. And then my last big laugh was, I know I'm listing my big laughs like this is a sitcom. It's like the saddest show on earth. When Kevin yells at that creepy guy and like says fuck, and then Matt Jameson, who's with him, goes, I say fuck too.
I love that line.
Super funny.
It's like you're priesting a little too hard right now, dude. It's okay. Yeah. You don't need to like form a connection with me right now.
Turn it down.
Yeah. This was stupid in my notes. I really like the line where Patty says in the delivery of the alternative, what we do is very, very hard. Really well delivered. And then I really didn't like the line that followed soon after where she's like, doubt is fire and fire burns you up into the very ashes or something. It's like, whoa, who wrote that? Relax. But it made me think doubt is fire and fire leads to hate and hate leads to the dark side. Oof, the ATFEC guy, the alcohol, tobacco, firearms, explosives, and cults guy, the first guess he has of who the cult is Tomorrow's Family, which is a good name for a cult.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. But those are all my notes.
I love it. And that's all I got. So let's take it to a brief musical break. And we will take a glass of water. And then we'll be right back to talk about Guest. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Chatsovers. I'm still Magellan, and Alan, you're still Alan. Hi, Alan.
I persist. Despite all things, I persist, Magellan. I'm still here. Thank you.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Not much. We're going to talk about a second episode.
Oh, we are? What is it, Magellan?
It's The Leftover Season 1, Episode 6, Guest. It was written by Damon Lindelof and Kath Lingenfelter, directed by Carl Franklin. It aired August 3rd, 2014. Alan, what happened in Guest?
In this episode, Nora takes care of unfinished business in Mapleton before heading to New York City for the second annual DROP conference. That's Departure-Related Occupations and Practices. Upset that her ID has been pinched, she scours the convention for her imposter while wearing a guest badge and ends up getting detoured by an amorous salesman, a best-selling author, and a rogue attendee. Magellan, that makes this episode sound like it is an action movie thriller. In reality, this is a fairly quiet but also kind of, in my opinion, like up and down, kind of awkward episode in parts. What's the take, brother? What do you think about Guest?
I really like Nora as a character. I think she's really interesting. I mean, it, just by design, is a character who is like kind of a nexus of the sort of grief feelings and the complications of that that we've been talking about, because she's so isolated and has been so impacted by the departure, and also because her job is that she goes around and collects people's testimony and sits face to face with people who have been impacted by the sudden departure. So she's one of my favorite characters. I think the thing that's kind of a bummer is this, for better and for worse, this episode is like a very classically crafted hero's journey story about Nora, where she goes to the unfamiliar place, she encounters all these trials, she gets the potion, which is the big bear hug with Wayne, and she comes home having changed. And I kind of don't want her to be different yet. Like, I wanted this really, what I wanted was like a normal drop conference, and I wanted an episode that was more slice of life. And what we got was something that was like really interesting and eventful. And I think honestly eventful, like, somewhat to the detriment of the episode and to the detriment of what they were trying to do with Nora as a character. That's my opinion, but I'm willing to be, you know, battled on that.
It makes me question where I found my, like, utter adoration for Carrie Coon's Nora Durst, because, like, yeah, she's the best part of this episode, and she is bringing so much, like, real character to it. The problem, yeah, I think, with this episode is that the drop conference is, like, ruined. This is the worst drop conference that they've ever had. And it's also a cast surrounding Nora of just, like, cartoon people. And, like, long swaths of this episode are her talking to people who I wouldn't consider in any way realistic. People who lack any sort of empathy and, like, lack any sort of humanity towards grief and that kind of thing. And, like, yeah, this is a show also about, this is an episode about, like, privileged people and how they navigate their privilege, but, like, I don't know, all the stuff around her felt really awkward. And then, like, getting her to Wayne, I thought was worth it, and I know we're gonna disagree a bit on that, but, like, I felt really weird literally up until we got into that room and I knew that it was Wayne, and my brain said, okay, this is, like you said, John, this is, like, the conclusion of the hero's journey. Something has to happen here. And that's what I liked about the back end of this episode. But I also agree that, like, you know, we talked at the end of Two Boats and a Helicopter about, like, oh, cool, it's nice that Matt Jameson now has an arc. But in a way, they're, like, kind of solving a lot of Nora's arc here. Not Noah's arc, Nora's arc.
Yeah, I'm curious what happens next with her. I guess that's the sort of mystery they want us to leave the episode with, which is, like, obviously Wayne's hug has done something, or she feels a certain, even if the hug didn't do something, she, like, has figured something out about herself and how she's been holding on to her grief that she's starting to let go of. So she's different by the end of the episode. And the question is, like, how different is this, like, an unnatural kind of change or what? And I don't really, I don't know. Like, I don't really find that interesting, a set of questions, because if I'm going to invest in a character, I want to feel like they are the ones driving their lives, you know? And it's weird to me to think about, well, how would I feel about a character who, like, has a magic spell cast on them that, like, takes a certain set of emotions away from them? Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily change who they are. Nora is still Nora, but, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's just a strange thing as a viewer to try to figure out what to do with that.
Yeah, and I compare it a lot to another series that we just discussed about grief, which is Twin Peaks: The Return. And
I was thinking about Twin Peaks: The Return when she was walking down that big hallway to Wayne. That was like a Twin Peaks: The Return moment.
She also had just run into a fucker named Ray, so it tracks.
Yeah, I wrote that in my notes.
That fucker Ray. But, like, how does Sarah Palmer handle grief in Twin Peaks: The Return? Without getting into spoilers, they use that to make a sort of, like, grand spiritual supernatural point that works, because that's what Twin Peaks is dealing in. But, like, they can't go supernatural with Nora, so her version of, like, I cannot fully accept grief right now is she goes to the playground and watches the kids play and creeps out the babysitter, and she leaves the puzzles in her kids' rooms undone. She doesn't put those away because the kids could come back. She buys children's cereal and literally empties and refills her fridge every week as if she's restocking the house for a family. Right. And, like, that's all handled in a beautiful, like, dialogue-free scene, couple of scenes at the top of the episode. And I think that stuff's amazing because it's like, this has become quotidian for Nora. I go to the store, I buy the sugary cereal, and, like, the meaning of the sugary cereal later when she talks to the woman in the bathroom, and you're like, okay, even that had a meaning. Like, this is a woman who is, like, committed to this routine, similar to how Matt is committed to his faith and how the Guilty Remnant are committed to their beliefs, and Kevin is committed to this false idea of justice. She's committed. This has to be the way her life works.
Yeah.
And so she's kind of locked in it. And, you know, before she even goes to New York, our first big, like, dramatic moment right before the theme song is she hires a sex worker and asks her very politely for several thousand dollars to take Nora's gun and shoot Nora in the chest while she wears a Kevlar vest and falls onto an air mattress. Which we are all the sex worker here who's like, I gotta go, dude. And Nora's has to be like, no, like, I know it's weird. I've done it before. You're not going to kill me, and I'll give you as much money as you need, but please, like, I need this. And it's intense, right? The woman is so afraid. She finally does it, and it works fine. Like, she shoots her, she gets knocked out, and then she wakes up, like, 5 seconds later after the woman's left. And it isn't until, like, Wayne talks to Nora that we're like, oh, she doesn't want to get rid of pain. She needs to, like, shake her body to the brink of death to remind herself, because one of the things about grief that's, like, really, really tough and goes undiscussed often is that, you know, it hurts actively for a while, but then it becomes like a scab. It hardens over and we forget about the way we felt when it first happened.
Right. Right.
And Nora is deeply, deeply afraid of completely forgetting about her husband and her kids. So whether it's getting shot or the way, like, some people turn to drugs or whatever, this is a woman with a lot of money and a lot of control over her situation. And this is her way of asserting it, is like, I have these routines, and every once in a while, I just need to snap myself into remembering I'm alive. Because, again, as Wayne says, like, the realm of the living is the realm of the hopeful. And she wants hope, but she needs to stay alive to do it. So was this, again, are there just so many, like, if this is too ridiculous for you, The Leftovers right now might not be for you. Maybe come back in a season or two when they get better at this. Was this a lot? This is a lot, right?
The gun scene?
Yeah, man.
Oh, it was great.
I'm glad you felt that way.
This I loved. Two scenes
even
that were my favorite scenes, and this is one of them.
Even though she plays Angel of Death by Slayer.
That was awesome. That was so great.
Because
to me, it's like, what I liked about this is how it situates it within the same routine as all the other stuff. And it makes Nora more complex. Like, she is the woman who, like you said, is restocking the whole fridge, is going through routines of a life that, like, force her to continue to come into contact with this memory. And she's like, I'm going to basically trap myself here in these routines. But also, like you said, that's not enough to hold on to the feeling, like the rawness of the feeling of my family is gone. And so I thought I really liked it. She's like, yeah, the thing I got to do is I need to hire people to shoot me. And it like made sense to me.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about this in a certain way. And people often complain that television isn't realistic enough. And if it's trying to depict real people, then why isn't it realistic enough? And I'm of two minds about this, because on one hand, I do, in a hypothetical situation, see a world where even I would do this, that like, this is a safe way to like jump up against death, right? Like some people skydive, but there's risk inherent in it. This is like as safe as she can possibly be, but still get to the borderline. And if you're really that desperate to feel something, like, yeah, it makes a sort of twisted sense. But my other mind of this is like, TV and art allow us to sort of explore ideas that we cannot put words to. That's like how poetry works, right? We try to communicate things and we fail to do them in our medium, so we use another medium. And so in television, this is how you communicate grief sometimes, is like it becomes extreme. It becomes so overbearing that you literally need to approach death to feel, to remind yourself. And I think that really works for me. And that is why The Leftovers is one of my favorite TV shows and why I love stuff like Lost. You know, Damon Lindelof and I are best friends. We hang out every weekend to play poker. Because he writes these episodes that you're like, that's a lot on paper. But when I'm there, I feel it and I empathize with it, because that's the human experience. It's greater than what we think we do on our day-to-day life.
Yeah. The power of fiction is that you can have characters. People want to watch or read about active characters, people who do stuff, not just people who think about doing stuff, but who actually do things. And fiction allows us to see characters who act on things that might only be passing thoughts in our minds. Like, I'm sure that everybody out there has thought a thought that something like, man, what would happen if I hired somebody to shoot me in the chest?
Yes.
Maybe not exactly that, but like everybody has had thoughts like that, whether intrusive or you entertain them for a little bit longer. And so like, yeah, let's watch it happen. Let's see what it's like.
Right.
And I think sometimes that leads the show to doing like really goofy stuff or getting a little too, I think the show can get a little too taken in by that. By that thing of like, we're going to keep having characters do like, I don't want to say unrealistic, but kind of like heightened realistic things.
Yeah.
And it does it a lot. And that's sort of like the thing of the show, which I respect. It's a pretty bold show. It's clearly a show made by people who have been making TV for a while. And so they're like, hey, I'm going to just go for broke and have this happen. And I think there's times where I don't love it. And I think there's times like this where it's like, yeah, this is awesome. And very few other shows have had the bravery to do stuff like this. Like, in a way, maybe like Mad Men was a show that couldn't do something exactly like this, but had that same sense of like, I'm going to watch characters do the thing that people only think about doing.
Brilliantly said. That, and that's my pitch for The Leftovers for people, is like, you're going to watch people do things that you've thought about doing in your deepest, darkest moments, and they're going to do it. And it's going to be weird, and you're going to be like, that's not how people act, but it's how people think. And it made it onto the page, and they had actors perform it, which is really beautiful, because we don't get to see that. So that's my other like big pitch for like why I love these moments and why I love Nora, as she does things that people like so many characters on the show that humans don't do. In real life all the time. But before we just, like, last thing before we get into the actual conference and her losing her ID, her boss or one of the people at her work is saying, hey, you know, these questions you're asking, we get a scene of her asking
them
again.
This was my other favorite scene, by the way. I love this scene so much.
Of the boss telling her this?
I fucking love this scene.
Yeah, So
this is my favorite scene of the episode, I think.
Wow, okay. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, he is like, question 102, which she covers it up a little bit. At this point in the episode, you're like, what's this weird question? But what the question is basically, Do you think that the departed, the people who she's asking about for the sake of the benefits, are in a better place? Mm-hmm. And the problem she's having is until now, she has a 100% yes rate on that. Because the boss thinks it's because she's telling people, I lost my family in the departure. And so naturally, mm-hmm. people are going to be like, yeah, they are in a better place because you want me to say that. And because people want to make other people feel good sometimes.
Right.
And that seems like the right thing to say. But she's like, I don't say that. So I think what it is she gives the energy that she wants people to say that.
Yes.
And there's something really beautiful about that. Without mm-hmm. saying it, she communicates to all 100% of her clients up until this episode that, yeah, they're going to a better place, right? Right? Please say mm-hmm. yes. With her eyes, with her performance. And there's just something great about that. And the boss really trying to be like a private sector, like tech boss of sorts, of being like, all right, like the numbers say that you're doing it. I don't know why you're doing it, but you are. Like, fix that.
Yeah.
And so that's her, like, the mystery or the question that the hero's journey is seeking to answer.
Yeah. I just love that the boss is like munching on that sandwich the whole time. And
it looked like a good sandwich.
It looks like a great sandwich. Like, this is the most normal place, normal office, guys eating a sandwich. Oh, your numbers are looking this way. And what a, on the face of it, boring procedural thing.
Yeah.
Oh, for some reason, like, there's an anomaly here in how people answer this question. As much as I, you know, have misgivings about Nora changing or what's up with the Wayne stuff or whatever, bookending the episode with her asking the question to somebody and that person says no, and we walk away from the episode thinking like, whoa, okay, what does that mean now? What's changed about Nora, and what does that mean about hope and the way that hope operates? Because like, that's the thing that Wayne takes from her, is mm-hmm. this desperation of clinging to the hope that the departed will return, right? And so the episode is kind of asking this really complicated thing about like, hope is painful. It's also like startlingly human. It's also comforting. It brings people together. The people who have hope kind of distinguish themselves from the people around them and are like anomalous, mm-hmm. but like it's a state of suffering. I don't know. It's thematically really rich and complicated. And I love that it's set up by this scene where the dude is just munching the sandwich like, man, it's kind of a weird set of results here. Nora, I might want to look into that. Yeah,
Nora's Odyssey happens at a boring convention for boring people after her boring boss tells her to fix things for her boring job. Like,
right.
And yet so much human experience is packed into this, right?
Yeah.
So she gets to New York, and her ID, there's an ID mix-up. The person who took the Nora Durst badge, which specifies that she's like a senior member and she's been to this place a couple times, has been taken. She is given the badge that says guest. She is removed of her identity and of her sort of privilege here and becomes just another guest at the convention. And this is where the episode starts to lose me a little bit. I want to talk about the bathroom scene, which is great. As Nora is like chasing down who she thinks at this mixer might be the person who stole her identity, she runs into a woman in the bathroom and the woman is like, oh, you remember me? And she's like, oh, sorry, you're not the person I thought you were. And says that at a cocktail party, she called this woman a, quote, a heartless bitch because she claimed that sugary cereal, there was research that sugary cereal might have been correlated with children's departure. And she's like, I said it at a cocktail party. It's like from an article I read online. Like, I just said it and you were so horrible to me. And to you, it was Tuesday. Like, you forgot about this. That's awful. So we're kind of given this portrait that Nora, like, is very likable and very relatable in the episodes we see her in. But she has, like, left a legacy of, like, being that cruel woman, which is, like, a very gendered concept, too. But, like, this is a woman in the bathroom being like, hey, that was awful what you said. And I understand why you said it, because I gave some, like, shitty data and was like, this is probably true. And you're mad about it, but you reacted in a way that was very, like, extreme.
Yeah, and I kind of just wanted to see Nora operate in that space and be that person, because what's a little strange to me about the way that this episode works is, like, in the Matt episode, we saw Matt being Matt in all the spaces that Matt can be Matt, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And in the Nora episode, we see Nora being Nora at home and at work, and then she goes to the conference, and suddenly she's like a different person in these spaces. She's really gets really mad at the person with the badges, which is interesting because you're like, okay, Nora has a lot of rage inside of her, kind of like Kevin, you know, and the ways that we've seen Kevin blow up at people. Okay, that's cool. And then the episode says, yeah, and now she's going to kind of be a different person. She's going to be guest, like this persona of Nora, and what's that's all about. And I'm sitting here thinking, okay, but I still haven't figured out who Conference Nora is, and now she's like a whole another person.
Yeah.
So
who is Nora?
Yeah, I really wanted to spend time with Nora, and instead we spent time with these like weird circumstances where Nora wasn't Nora, which was like kind of interesting. I liked when everyone was like guest, yeah, hey guest, what's up guest, like that's kind of funny, but I don't know, it wasn't worth it to me.
No, it to me really pushed into the ridiculous here. She meets a guy named Marcus. He's like, ask me what I do for work. She's like, what do you do for work? He's like, I can't. What is he like? I can't tell you. And that's his pickup line. You don't want to know, which is his pickup line. And she's like, okay, bye. But later she sees him in an elevator and she gets invited to this, like, honestly, maybe controversial. We can discuss this. I think you can cut this whole scene out.
Okay.
I like the part where she straddles the corpse doll. I think that's like powerful because, you know, bodies, dead people, grief. It's like packed of peanuts. But all of this stuff, like, why? Do we really need Crowded House, Don't Dream It's Over at this party? Did we really need Nora taking drugs? Did we really need, like, everybody getting drunk and sitting on the floor and being like, what does your company even do? Like, all of that just felt like completely out of reality in a way that, unlike the teens, where I said in the pilot, like, oh, works at the teens are ridiculous because they like life means nothing to them. It's just like this is a bunch of 30-somethings, and it's just sad. It's just sad and doesn't feel like it needs to be here to show us that, like, Nora. It really brings us to, like, Nora blacks out and then wakes up the next day in the security at her door, right?
Here's what I think is the issue with it.
Yeah.
Who were those people?
No one. We don't learn who any of them are. They barely get names.
Because when we meet Marcus, he doesn't even have a name badge, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, are you at the conference? Do you work at the hotel? And then we learn he works for the company that sells the replicas of people to be buried. And then it's like, wait, okay, so are all these people conference people who think the conference is stupid? Like, they aren't really set up in a way that really reads. None of them have badges, but they all seem to know about the conference. Maybe they work for the hotel. Like, I just don't get a clear sense of who they are and who Nora is to them and why she's with them. You could have done this with people who go to the conference all the time, who know each other because they're always at these same conferences. And then there's like this weird letting off steam orgy that they all do every time they're at the conference or something. Like, that's the same kind of Buck Wild, but it like has a context, you know? So that for me was what didn't work about this, is I didn't fully have a sense of like, who are you? Like, why are we here?
It's kind of a persistent issue I've had with The Leftovers on this rewatch, is that the like regular people characters, the not relevant to our story characters, are like never, they're like NPCs. They never feel like real people. And I don't know what that is. Is that a writing thing? Is that a acting thing? But it's always like we have real people surrounded by NPCs. And that's what it feels like in here, is these people exist to tell Nora that like they think the convention is stupid and people who like obsess over their loved departed ones are like, you know, delusional or whatever. And it's like, okay, yeah, they suck. Great. Mm-hmm. People are bad. I know that already. I've seen this.
I think the other missed opportunity is this is a conference where the selling point, the thing I was interested about coming to watch it, was this is a conference for all these people who have careers that are based around the departure, right?
Yeah.
And like, we don't meet anybody with careers based around the departure except for the fake corpse guy and Nora.
And two authors, mind you, like two people who write books about the Departure who are both proven to be charlatans.
True. True.
So, like, that's people who are related to the Departure is Nora and a bunch of charlatans, basically.
Right. But just give me, like, a quick montage of Nora's at this, like, like drug orgy party, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, I do this. I do this. Yeah, oh, my thing is I do this. Give me, like, you know, 10 different ideas of all these weird occupations at this conference.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a really good point. And what we do instead get is just a lot of, like, the security questioning her and being like, why did you do this? And she's like, it was obviously my doppelganger. My question plot-wise about this is, do they not have cameras? Why would they ever believe Nora Durst did this?
Right.
If they're looking at her, she has her ID, and they have evidence that the person that broke the glass in the bar wasn't her. Why are they questioning her?
Yeah. Yeah.
My only guess is, like, they didn't have cameras available, or it wasn't clear enough or something like that. So
yeah, but they don't even say that to address that.
No. They're just like, a person named Nora Durst broke the glass in our bar, and that's obviously you, so you're under arrest. It's like, or you're kicked out of our hotel, and it's like, what? You know I'm not.
Yeah.
Whatever. Fortunately, they don't belabor it. She gets to the conference that she was supposed to go to, and the fake Nora Durst is at the stage. It turns out a woman stole her ID so that she could kind of espouse on microphone to all these people about her conspiracy theories. You can hear her as she's getting it taken away say, quote, the Mossad regime was working on ray guns in Iran that leave no matter behind, suggesting, like, it was an op or something. And then she just gets taken away, and Nora's like, that sucked. And we just cut to her in the bar, and they're like, yeah, you can have whatever drinks you want. You're fine. And then we're back. Then we're like, okay, now we're in the stuff that Alan likes again. We see Jonathan, one of the book authors, at the bar with her, and they seem like they're having a normal conversation. And I think it's he who says we can't spend all of our lives waiting for something that never comes. And then she says back that never comes back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Loved that. Really into that, solidifying that she's like, yeah, but we're not, we don't agree that this is permanent, right? Like, we know that this is, they're going to come back. What do you mean not coming?
Yeah.
And he just has this, like, very apathetic ethos about everything and seems like such a fraud from the jump. And it turns out he is, because this, in the background of this episode, we keep seeing people talk about this, like, religious guy who's another author, and he keeps asking people if they want to feel this way. But John, you mentioned that you had Wayne vibes from this guy from the jump, correct?
Mm-hmm.
He definitely has that. Like, do you want to feel this way? Can I get rid of this for you? He intercepts Nora outside of the convention and takes her. She, like, very quickly believes him. It's kind of weird how quickly she's like, yeah, all right, I'll go to this weird apartment in, like, this back room. But again, for her, I feel like it's one, narrative convenience, and two, like, what else is she going to do? She's the same person who, top of the episode, was like, hey, Kevin, want to come to Miami with me? Which we didn't talk about, but she has a meet cute with Kevin at the top, and she's like, I don't want to go.
Love that.
She's just, he's like, I have a daughter. And she goes, oh, fuck your daughter. Oh, wait, I'm not supposed to say that. Oh, that's that's a bad thing to say, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't realize until her whole odyssey later that she's like, yeah, sorry I said fuck your daughter. That was really rude. And he's like, no, I would have gone. I just needed
that actually sounded pretty nice.
I was just trying
to think about the logistics of it, and you walked away.
It's like how a real rom-com would work, with someone to be like, come away with me. And you're like, I have work today and I have a kid. That's
Hold on. Give me like 30 seconds to figure
and
this out.
Like, I don't. You bought the plane ticket
somebody.
Already. You're like, oh, Christ. You tell my bank that I'm traveling.
That's funny.
Oh, boy. Yeah. So she yells at this guy and is like drunkenly screaming at him as he leaves. And then. So the author takes her up, and there he is. It's actually Wayne. He's in this creepy, dark, dank hotel room. I love how kind of unhinged he is here at first, where he's like, all right, what? Yeah, you need healing? You gave me your $1,000 already. I'm going to hug you. He, like, just has the script, basically, and is like, what's your pain? And it feels like she kind of breaks through to him for a sec, because she's like... He's like, who did you? You lost someone, right? Like, he says to everyone, like, oh, you lost someone. And then she looks at him and he goes, oh, you lost someone's. Ooh, yeah, that's a lot, isn't it? You lost everyone. And he cites some Bible verses at her. For whoever is joined with all the living, there is hope. I really like that moment. And this all concludes in a big Wayne hug, which is a really difficult thing to parse, right? Because on one hand, we see the actor Patterson Joseph like smile with an unreasonable like happiness here. You're like, oh, that's gross. I actually feel weird that he's so into this, like, because we know he sucks. But it's working for her. Like the quote unquote magic of Wayne's hugs is it's entirely in your head. It's entirely what you bring to it, and she's bringing. I need to clear this pain from my brain. I don't want to feel this way anymore. I do want to remember, but I need to like be absolved, sort of.
Right.
It's like confession. You know, I wrote in my notes that Nora's like insurance questionnaire is sort of a like religious confession because you have to be honest, and it like forces you to dig into things you feel that are sometimes uncomfortable. And so now she's getting that. She finally gets to be the person who's like asked these questions and given the things she wants. How did you feel about the Wayne hug, man?
I think I've already said some of what I have misgivings about, which is just like, if this is a genuinely supernatural thing where Wayne deleted emotions of hers, I don't like that, because you're like taking away a slice of a character in a way that's hard for me to figure out what to do with, which it feels like is what's going on. This feels to me like Wayne actually has some kind of power or something. I could be wrong, and it could just be he's just really good at reading people and like breaking them down in conversation, because he gets Nora to a T just from looking at her. So it could be that. But the scene itself, you know, I think it's a really great deconstruction of what Nora's deal is, and I think it introduces this really fascinating theme that I talked about earlier, where he says, hope, it's your weakness. And thinking about hope as a weakness is something new, you know, is not often framed that way. But, you know, it raises the question of like, do I agree with that? What does it mean for Wayne to say that sort of thing? Is there sense to what Wayne is saying, or is that a manipulation? So I think it's challenging in the right sorts of ways. And then I think it also makes you question, what's Wayne's deal? Like, why does he want to hug people? Is it just for thousands of dollars? Because he also says, I've seen my own death and it's coming upon me very soon. So like, what's in it for Wayne? Does he feel like he's helping people? Does he feel like he's exerting some kind of power or something? So that it got me more interested in Wayne, I think, in some ways. Yeah. If this is where the show is going to go, it's going to do this sort of thing. But it got me a little less interested in Nora, which is kind of a bummer, because I think she's really cool and interesting. And I hope that it wasn't supernatural feeling deletion. Mm-hmm. It was just like a really impactful conversation.
I think what you said there, though, is really telling about what the show is trying to do with Wayne, though. Like you said, what are we left with, basically, if it worked? If it actually worked, then like, what is Nora's character? Like, why do we care about her? And that's something that's really interesting about people like the Garveys, who don't do things like hug Wayne, you know, because they're like, I don't want to lose that because I don't become a character anymore. If I lose like my grief and my hope or whatever, then like I become a blank slate and I don't want that. And we worry at the end of this episode because, I mean, hell, she gets out and the first interview she does, we get a tearful, tearful moment from the interviewee who says no to question 121. And it's like, oh, fuck, it totally worked. And I think that is in a way that like how faith can work is you're like, well, I saw the evidence, so I guess what Wayne did must have worked. Like within the confines of this episode and what we understand about TV, then like, yeah, it seems like it's working. It could also still be a coincidence. Like, maybe she just got lucky finally. Or maybe she changed her mindset. Or maybe she carries herself differently after this experience. It's a combination of things. And I think that's what I ultimately do like about the Wayne stuff is you can't just holistically accept that it's fake or real, because it loses its dramatic weight if either of those things happen.
Yeah, I think honestly all of my feelings about it just come from I need to watch later episodes to get a full picture of what I think about it. And so stopping here and taking stock of how I feel a lot of unresolved things because it's episode six of a TV show. I think the thing that challenged me in this episode that is along those lines that I really liked comes from the conversation that Nora had with the author in the bar, where he's telling the anecdote about his daughter and about how he saw her playing and laughing, and then she looks at him as if she's not sure if she's allowed to be happy. And that might also be where some of my discomfort is coming from, because I think that's the kind of person that I am in the wake of like a tragic event or something bad happening, is feeling this feeling of like, you know, I shouldn't feel anything positive. Mm-hmm. Like, even if I do, it, you know, I'm not supposed to at this time. I don't know. You know, letting go of that is difficult, and seeing a character kind of like hand wave and seemingly let go of it is weird. But, you know, obviously there's probably more to see here.
Yeah. And I think about this stuff constantly, like with COVID and with thinking about this show, is like, what's the value in letting go of all of those things and quote unquote, just moving on? Like people say in the episode before this in Gladys. And people say to Nora, it's like, why can't you just get over this? It brings me to my Bible verse quote that I referenced earlier, which is it's Matthew 5:4. And it's, blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. It's pretty straightforward. The Bible literally says it's worth mourning people. It's worth caring and remembering the people that were gone, because they want that. And it kind of makes me think about like the relationship between those who are departed and those who are quote unquote left behind. And like, are they gone? Because they're not dead. We know they're not dead. Mm-hmm. And are they going to come back? Is there a relationship with them that is bigger than just like, you know, the way that humans interact with other humans? Is there something spiritual between those who were left behind and those who were gone? It's just something to like think about as the show goes on. And I really like that about this ending.
Right.
And then we end with the credits on Pass Them by Agnes Obel, which is a very pretty song. I liked it a lot.
After Nora and Kevin agree to go on their date, of course.
Yeah. They have their meet cute. He's like, can I ask you out? You'll like get dinner sometime? And she's like, yeah, you can. We're both really hot. We're both really hot, Kevin. He's like, yeah, we are. Okay, bye.
Okay, see you later.
Sounds good.
No exchange of numbers or time place.
He also says, I found your address, which is weird.
Yeah, super weird. It was easier to find than your phone number. Now's the time to ask for the phone number, bud.
That's it. Now go ahead and do it. Or pick a place, pick a time. He's just like, can I ask you out? Yes. Okay.
Okay. Bye. Next time I run into you in a random location, I'll ask you out.
Okay. Magellan, hit me with your stray notes, please. I have actually none for this episode.
Wow. A concept that I think was interesting that was brought up in the background is there's a session at the conference talking about the prophet's dilemma, which I didn't write anything that they said about it, but I looked it up, and the prophet's dilemma is like the same thing as a self-defeating prophecy, basically.
Yeah.
They're talking about how during events like these, where there's like a greater kind of mass trauma, there's more like false prophets or people making self-defeating predictions and stuff. I don't know. I'd have to rewatch the scene to fully unpack how does that tie thematically with the episode, but that was interesting to me.
Yeah.
As like a tool to analyze this potentially. The security guy with this fucking big mustache, like, what are we doing? That was dorky.
Just a funny bit of casting, I think.
Yeah. And the hotel boss, just the most New York hotel boss ever.
Hey, what's going on? Yeah.
Silly. Mm-hmm. Also big Twin Peaks of Return energy, but in a bad way. Like, they didn't do it right. They didn't do the Vegas boss stuff correctly.
I agree with you for sure.
The guy says, do you want to feel this way, to Nora? And she says, yeah, I want to feel this way. Fuck off.
Yes. Move on. Next
the
question.
The PayPal screen that fucker Ray is looking at is the old PayPal.
Really old.
Super crusty PayPal.
Yep. I thought that was funny that he was like, yeah, that guy like looks like a generic street tough or like a male porn star or something. He's just like, what's up? I'm Ray. It's your PayPal. You got PayPal? I can set one up for you if you want. But I thought that was very funny.
Mm-hmm. And then the last note I have is the comedy of when Angel comes over in that first scene to shoot Nora,
yeah.
she asks, why didn't you just get the person who shot you last time? And Nora said, she said she wouldn't do it again.
Boom. Boom, boom.
The Leftovers is a funny show, is the thing. It's very sad it's and very thought-provoking, but it's also hilarious.
Yeah. Also, we get the bit where Matt is calling her to apologize. So they haven't been speaking, I guess, since he told her the information. And we see her acting on the information that her husband was cheating on her. The scene where she's at the courthouse and she chooses to keep her name but dissolve her marriage. And also the interesting legal complication that, like, okay, this is dissolved for now, but if he comes back, you're not actually fully divorced.
Wild.
Yet. Which is wild and is fascinating because, like, that's a legal question you have to answer now in a world where a bunch of people disappeared, is how does divorce work? So I like that scene too.
Continuing to build on your everybody's going to come back theory.
Yeah, I think so.
I love it. I love it. Anything else?
Nope.
Groombo, which is the little alien that comes into my head whenever I need to make a transition. That's what we have for now. Hey guys, real quick. Next week we are not releasing another episode of the Chats Overs because if you keep up with our other podcast feeds or just the main chats feed, you know that every 3 months we do Trek Chats, which is a podcast where John and I watch Star Trek The Next Generation for the first time. So today is June 26, 2022. On July 3rd, you're going to be getting Trek Chat 02. And then on July 10th, you're going to get the next Chats Overs episode. So we didn't remember that, and because of our, like, recording and release schedule when this next part you're about to hear was being recorded. But that's the upcoming release schedule. Next week is Trek Chats, then the episode discussions that you're about to hear me describe now. First off, first things first, I want to tell you, Magellan, what we're watching next week on the Chats Overs.
Okay.
We are nearing the end of season one, with discussions of episodes 7 and 8 of season 1, Solace for Tired Feet, the summary of which is as follows. After learning his father has escaped the psychiatric hospital, Kevin orders an APB to track him down. Jill attempts to break an endurance record. And holed up in Indiana, a disillusioned Tom makes an unsettling discovery. So we got a premise there. We got Kevin's dad getting out. We got the kids doing stuff. It's a Garvey episode.
Okay.
Episode 8, Cairo. Oh, I might need to be careful with this one. I'm going to skip the Kevin part. Jill remains skeptical of Nora and goes through a personal conflict. The guilty remnant prepares for an important event. Meg has an altercation with Matt.
Whoa, okay. That's a pairing.
Yep. So, Solace for Tired Feet in Cairo next week, folks. Get hype for those. Magellan, first question for you. Where can people find you on the podcast sphere?
You can also listen to me on a show called Super Smash Echoes, which I do every month with my good friend Justin, where we play games that are the sources of Super Smash Brothers characters or are influenced by the games in the Super Smash Brothers universe. So games that echo or the echoes of games. It's a monthly video game book club type thing, Super Smash Echoes. We just played this really interesting free RPG thing called Franken. It's like an hour long game that was kind
about
of
about Al Franken.
It's not about Al Franken, no. That was kind of like a break in the rhythm for us as we move through Earthbound. And it was a really fun episode about something you probably haven't heard of that you could play in an hour and then listen to our episode. So check it out. Super Smash Echoes. Alan, what about you?
Generally, you can find me on another podcast, which is The Huntress Quorum. That's a Monster Hunter podcast I do with friend of the podcast, Six. Every week or so, we do discussions with myself, Six. And lately, we've been having the internet's Minofsky article. Minofsky is a wonderful human being, and we talk about Monster Hunter monsters together and have a great time, and we laugh a lot. We recently did an episode with another friend, Dylan, and we've been putting out some really good stuff over there. I was also on a recent episode of Scanline Media's Oops All Anime podcast, where I was asked to watch the Mobile Suit Gundam movie Kukuru's Doan's Island, which is an hour 40 movie that is an extension of a 20-minute episode of the original series that was also not broadcast in the U.S. So it's really weird. We had a great time talking about it. You can find that over on patreon.com/scanlinemedia. And let's talk about us for a sec, folks. It's time to pay the bills, big money, baby. I would like to do the plug zone, if you don't mind, Magellan. Please let me have
it. Go for it.
Thanks, pal. If you would like to get in contact with us, our email address is chatspod@gmail.com. Our Twitter account is @chatspod, and our subreddit run by the community is rchatspod. If you like the show, please consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. That really helps us get the word out there. Honest to goodness, sincerely, it does, and we love that. And if you would like to support us financially, we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/chatspod. Check out our Patreon for all sorts of bonus content. $1 a month gets you a couple sweet bonus things, including Magellan's solo X-Files podcast that he releases when he can. And it also gets you our love and affection. $3 gets you all of that and even more. It gives you literally 3+ years of backlog content where we commentary movies, where we talk about whatever. We're reading funny advice and ranking it in a tier list. We're doing fun joke stuff. We do pile chats. We watch all sorts of cool shit. And we have a wheel spun by that we spin filled with suggestions from patrons. It's great. $5 on the Patreon every month gets you a thank you at the end of the main feed episodes. And as of today, our $5 patrons include, I'm going to do this in a sing-songy voice to kind of mix it up, Arthur and Chloe and Jen and Kat and Lee and Magellan's mom and Marcus, Marin, Michael and Nick and Pat of the Brothers at Infinite War. We got Fendon and Six. And who can forget about Stefan? That was really hard for me, so please clap.
Yay.
I'm drenched in sweat from doing that. Also, it's really hot in my headphones, so that's what we have. Chatspod.com. Thanks, Magellan. Appreciate you. Chatspod.com. That's the zone to find all things chats, television, podcasts. Check out the website. And thank you to Camilla Strader, the Camilla Illustrator that does our podcast art. You can find her at Camilla Strader on social media. And that's all I got. I'll do a final segment, though, before we go home. We have Chatsums. Yum. Hum. It's a little pickle that we eat at the end of the episode where we recommend you something.
Yeah.
Eating a pickle. So go ahead, recommend the kids something, Magellan, please.
All right. My Chatsum. So I have another Star Wars YouTube channel, 100% Star Wars. It's fun. It's good. If you are a fan of a particular Star Wars video game that I'm a fan of, that I'm going to chat some to you right now, and that's Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. Okay, have you ever heard of it?
Sure.
I've been playing it on the Nintendo Switch because they just put out the Switch port to Knights of the Old Republic 2, and in the near future, they're going to be adding the Restored Content DLC to the Switch port, which is very exciting because I've never played the Restored Content mod that fans made. And so they're going to add that fan-made mod to the Switch version. It's all going to be in one officially released package. So I'm replaying KOTOR 1 to get to KOTOR 2. KOTOR 1 is a fucking great video game if you haven't played it. It's wonderful. It's one of my favorite games of all time. Still holds up. 100% Star Wars is a YouTube channel that does a lot of KOTOR-related content. So welcome to my zone of life. Enjoy it while you're here. I'm on Terrace. I'm having a great time making light side choices, talking to Atten, not Atten, talking that he's in KOTOR 2, talking to Karth Onassi at every possible chance I get, trying to get that guy to open up about his feelings.
Kiss me on the lips, maybe.
Trying to get him to kiss me on the lips just a little bit. Trying to figure out, where's Bastila at? What's up with these swoop bike gangs? What's up with Dave, that guy who's a swoop bike guy.
David Dobrik is in this game?
David Dobrik is a bad man in this game. He wants the medicine for himself. The Sith are on this planet. They're blockading. And now I'm playing Pazok. And I'm crushing it at Pazok. I'm winning so many credits. KOTOR, baby. It's on the Switch. It's not too bad to play on there. It's obviously not built for console, but it fits great in the palm of your hand. So, that's what I'd say.
Thanks, pal. You want to chat some for me?
What's your chat some?
Can I give you two?
Okay.
I want to shout out a TV show that I've been binging. This past weekend, I watched 4 episodes back-to-back of Severance, the Apple TV Plus office
Wow.
drama suspense comedy about
yeah.
Elevator pitch is the following. What if when you went to work, your brain shut off and a work version of yourself turned on? And then when you clocked out, the work version turned off and your brain turned back on. Do you think that'd be kind of cool? Wrong. That would be really fucked up and scary and would allow your work to manipulate you. What if you also worked for an evil corporation? What if you found out that you were two different brains? Hold on. That's the mystery at the core of Severance, which is written and created by a bunch of comedy people. I think most of the episodes are directed by Ben Stiller, which is bananas. And it stars Adam Scott, noted comedy funny serious man Adam Scott. And you think, oh, it's like a wacky haha show. And like, yeah, it's really funny, but it's also really bleak. It makes you think about capitalism a lot. And I'm only about like a third of the way through it. And I hear it gets absolutely buck the truck wild later. So it's 9 episodes? It's like, what's one season? I know nobody likes Apple TV Plus. That's why it's not my only chatsum, but it's on there. That's what I'm liking right now. It's Severance. It's a good show. The book that I'm reading for June, though, now that I finished A Natural History of Transition, I actually met somebody recently who is going to meet the author of that book at like a signing. So secondhand degree, I met Callum Angus. My book chatsum is The Poppy War by R.F. Kuang. It's the first in a trilogy of fantasy books that came out. This one came out in 2018. It's based in Chinese, Japanese, East Asian history all across the board from different parts of history. It's your typical young girl hero's journey, discovers she has magic powers, goes to a magic school story. But it is also deeply political and concerned with how young people can change the world and like create revolutions. And it's fantastic. I cannot rave about it enough. It's super well written. I cannot put it down every day. When I do my 30 minutes of reading, I'm like, I should probably squeeze a little bit more Poppy War in there. And it's just really, really good. If you think that you're too old or not, if you're over like young adult like kind of fiction, please give the Poppy War a shot. It's very good. And I know I'm late to the party for those who've read it, but it does slap. It really does. I'm tired of hearing my own voice. I'm tired of talking. I want to go to bed. Magellan, thank you for being the Patty to my Lori, you know? Thank you for pulling me out of this rut and reminding me why I do this. Wow.
You're going to have the bacon.
Coffee?
The waffles.
Or orange juice and coffee? Oh, God, she orders Lori orange juice and coffee. Oh, God, never mind.
Just to test her, just to see if she'll say something.
That's why she does it.
Ew, gross.
You nailed
that's
it.
That's what breaks her.
Holy gotcha. Crap. She finally talks. That's the first time we hear from Lori. She's like, oh, what is this, a cereal commercial? Milk and orange juice? Yuck.
She's like, I'll see myself out.
I'll leave. You can have my white outfit. Thank you, dear listener, for being the listener to my podcaster.
Well, you know what? Sorry. You know what's cool about the whistle scene?
What's cool about the whistle scene?
Is like Lori's like shouting at him. Like she doesn't get to talk, but she could wail on that whistle. And isn't that kind of an interesting, fun Sonic thing that's happening there?
I love Sonic in his big shoes. sometimes when like Patty would write in the first couple episodes on her pad, she'd write really hard, and I took that as her speaking like this, but she's just writing. Isn't that cool? Language. Mm-hmm. Anyways, guys, thank you so much for listening to the chatsovers, where we remember so that you don't forget.